rise. The Court of Appeals Division 1 is now in session.
All right, thank you, folks. Have a seat. So, good morning. We are here for oral arguments in 1 CACV. I should flip the page. 250326 FC, Biltis v. Biltis. These proceedings are being video and audio recorded and live streamed as well. So please, when you approach the podium, state your name and identify the party that you are representing so the folks who may be watching remotely know who's speaking and why. Each of you do have 20 minutes. You're not required to use them all, but if you feel the need to, please do. But we ask that you focus your arguments for today's hearing. Appellate's counsel is responsible, of course, as you well know, for watching the time and reserving any portion for rebuttal. Please let us know, but we're not going to protect it for you. Also, please keep in mind that we have spent a good deal of time reading the briefs. We have conferenced the case this morning, so we are very well aware of what has happened, though I know we have a great number of questions for you folks. So with that, counsel, you may proceed.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Peter Swan, and here with Keith Berkshire, I represent appellant, cross-appellee, husband, Jack Biltis. Your Honor, we're all familiar with the rule that the Court of Appeals, if the Court of Appeals can affirm on any ground, then it must affirm. But here, the decree is facially contrary to law, and regardless of the trial court's reasoning, it's impossible to hold that this decree complies with Title 25 or the controlling case law. And the main feature or failure of the decree, its failure to divide key assets, is one upon apparently which both sides agree. This appeal doesn't dance around discretionary awards or question the weighing of evidence. It goes to the very nature of a dissolution. And the decree in this case failed to comply with ARS 25318 in such fundamental ways that I submit a comprehensive remand is required. I say
so where the parties agree is really as to the PV house?
Yes.
That's the agreement that there was a failure to divide.
That there was a failure to divide, yes.
Beyond that, I don't know that. I just want to make sure I'm clear. There's an agreement as to that piece.
And I then think what that's
do we
fair.
That's the only piece we find. Do we comprehensively remand at that point? And I'm just asking that question.
Well, Your Honor, I think you'd have to. And the reason I say that is that in this case, this is an unusual case, obviously, with unusual assets. And in this case, the PV home.
Or maybe not assets.
Fair point. The PV home is so intertwined with the business that its very ownership status was left in doubt by the decree. And once you remand on the PV home, the entire ball of string starts to unravel. And I don't see any way to remand on that one discrete issue. So you're correct, Your Honor, I think, as to the scope of the party's agreement on the failure.
So let me just ask, so were the PV home or the Scottsdale home too? All of it?
Well, yes, because the Scottsdale home is then wrapped up in other issues because the decree actually awards the equity to my client or portion of the equity in the Scottsdale home to my client and then takes it away later on for reasons that are related to the PV home. So once we recognize that the failure to divide exists, the decree can't be affirmed across the board, and everything in this case is so interrelated that we then have to reassess the entire scheme of division, I would say.
Let me ask you, if we have to do that with that, do we have to reach any of the other issues? Do we just send it back and say, well, we know you're going to have to redo it all and let the trial court sort it out with that one ruling, and then if it doesn't, then you folks can work the rest of this out, or is there some part of it that we absolutely have to reach?
Well, it's an interesting question because it is true you could remand the entire case based on that one issue, but there are a couple of significant principles of law here, a couple of significant errors that are so significant that I think if this court remanded them without comment, it would do a disservice to the next trial.
Let's focus on those very specific issues that we really need to look at. Because the parties have agreed that that's it. Now, again, we're getting a little further down the road, but what three things, whatever they are you focused on?
Well, I'm focused on specifically two legal issues that I think require comment by this court, and frankly, I think are opinion worthy. One of them is the issue of the availability of a receiver in a post-decree, frankly, even a pre-decree context, but certainly in a post-decree context in a dissolution case. And I'm perfectly prepared to argue that, but I think if this court were to remand without comment on that issue, it would do a disservice to the future trial judge having to hear this case.
Counsel, on that point, can you just talk a little bit about procedurally what might have happened below? I mean, it seems like it wasn't brought up until a pretrial statement right before trial as that being an issue. And maybe that's why the court did it in the decree, because to me, I'm like, why didn't the court appoint the receiver, you know, way before this, and so that the issues were resolved in finalizing the decree? Can you speak to that at all?
Sure. Well, Your Honor, I think the reason the court didn't appoint the receiver beforehand is it hasn't been done since the adoption of Title 25. And the last time it was done was in the Great Depression, and the receiver appointed in that case was the husband.
Well, there's no published opinion about it, but I don't know that we can say that there's never been a receivership, even on a temporary basis, to try and help while the court's sorting out the property, for example, to protect the assets.
I'm talking about post-decree, Your Honor.
Okay, post-decree. Okay, I'm sorry. I just went, because you had also said, questioned its ability to be used pre-decree, and I'm not sure that I would buy the idea that it can't be done pre-decree.
I think there might be circumstances under which a pre-decree receiver would be permissible if the statute and the rule are complied with, but neither happened in this case.
Okay, so if we sent it back, it's possible the court could say, first, I'm going to keep this receivership as a temporary receivership while I work through this now. Because I want to be clear, if we do send it back in the receivership issue, and I don't necessarily disagree we need to talk about it, I don't think we tell the court that it can't leave that receivership in place as a temporary order.
Well,
as long as it complies, I get it.
That's a little complex because I hope the court or the panel received our notice that we filed. There is another appeal pending that could be mooted by this case, but there is another appeal pending about the scope of that receivership order. I think to leave that order in place would be absolutely erroneous. For one thing...
Well, no, I'm not saying we leave it in place, but the court could put it back in when we send it back. I mean, we vacate the award, let it be there.
I don't think this court needs to instruct the trial court that it couldn't ever put in a pre-decree receiver, but putting in an order that... has the receiver managing a court-imposed, court-created partnership, putting in effect an order that precludes the parties from exercising their federal rights in bankruptcy court. These sorts of things need to be vacated.
What you just said, that the court can't say, look, you both own it, it's here, you both continue to own it. That happens all the time with property. That is not something novel or unusual.
Actually, Your Honor, I don't believe that the failure to divide this closely held business can be held to comply with Kelsch, with Dole, or with Larchik. In all of those decisions, especially Kelsch, the idea is that once the 25318, unlike in the Acker case where 25318 didn't exist, 25318, Larchik made very clear, requires simultaneous division of property at the time of dissolution. And that division of property means that each party walks away with a sole and separate interest and neither is entitled to profit from the other's post-dissolution efforts. Here, the court created a business partnership. I have not seen that done ever in the history of Arizona law.
That may be fine, but you're saying that, and this is, you're asking this to be a matter of law across the state,
mm-hmm.
that If parties have a closely held company, it has to go to one or the other, and it can't just simply be you both continue to hold an equal interest and then proceed just like you would as any other business. You two don't like each other. This happens all the time, and you have rights as a business owner. Each of you can bring your lawsuits. Each of you can do what you do in a civil case as co-owners of a business. We're not responsible. That's your problem with the receivership, too. You're saying they need to be decide how to move forward.
I'm suggesting, Your Honor, that a court errs as a matter of law, and it should be the decision of this court, that a court errs as a matter of law when, after a dissolution, it leaves parties with fiduciary duties to one another.
Not in the marriage, though. The fiduciary duties existed before the marriage. They co-owned the business. They had the same duties. It's not changing that. It's just simply saying, yep, you both have the same, you have your co-ownership.
With due respect, Your Honor, the duties did not exist in this way before the divorce. The court has ordered that wife receive a six-figure salary from this business for doing nothing, and that can't change.
I'm talking about just the ownership interest. Let's set aside the rest. I'm talking about you know, two people are married and they own a business together. Carpet cleaning, apartment building, I don't care what it is. That we can't just say you're going to continue as co-owners. That we don't. There's nothing in the law that I see that makes it us make one of them get it as sole and separate property.
I think the Martin case is one that deserves attention on that point. The Martin case does make clear that it can be impossible to effectively divide a closely held business because the separate interest that each party receives is unmarketable and not subject to valuation in any context other than a voluntary partnership which now no longer exists. The cases Kelsch, Martin certainly strongly favor the award to one with an equalization payment to the other and acknowledge that sometimes it may be impossible. And
should we leave it to the Superior Court at this point to decide if it's impossible here? If we remand, let's just assume we remand.
Well, I think
why wouldn't we leave it to the court to decide that?
I think you might be able to do that if the decision highlights the difficulties with the way this business was left undivided. But I don't think that's
something you want to take up with the Superior Court on remand. You're asking us to try and help write a little bit of an argument that you might make below.
No, I'm asking
to say, hey, look at Martin in the other cases.
I'm asking for a holding that says, in these circumstances, when there is no actual division of a business and it is then held by a trust or a receiver in perpetuity, that does not affect the decision contemplated by 25318. I'm not asking the court to speculate on any other possible results.
And I understand your argument and what you're asking us to do, but I guess my question is, we started with, we're sending this back, and because the PV home, the failure to divide that, created issues in all of the property division. So wouldn't this issue also be on the table, and all of these arguments can be made below? I think that's what Judge Goss is referring to. And therefore, we don't even need to decide that issue because you can argue, you know, the Larrick case, the Kelsch case down below and have this addressed there.
Well, my point to the court is that, yes, obviously the Superior Court is going to have to fashion another division. There's no way out of that, and I'm not asking this court to do it. But what I am asking this court to do is issue a decision that does not either intentionally or unintentionally lend weight to the method of division that was employed here, because I believe it's utterly unworkable and utterly illegal by the time we get to the receiver.
So if I understand correctly, obviously you have concerns with the division of the property, and that encompasses all of the division, not just the PV home.
It also encompasses the debt.
Right. So all of the assets and debts of that the parties have, and the appointment of the receiver. And doesn't that sort of encompass everything that we're talking about here? so we don't need to, what I'm getting at is we don't really need to get into whether the division of the business was proper or improper. We're just saying that this whole thing needs to be relooked at.
Without any prejudice, Superior Court and the parties making their arguments. And that's what we do, and then you do it.
Well, Your Honor, I think that this case is going to result in either a memorandum decision or an opinion that is going to
That would generally be the outcome.
Yes. Well, it could be an order, but probably a memo or an opinion that is going to serve as guidance to future trial judges and future lawyers. And I think simply not commenting on the very unusual steps the trial court took here would be a tacit endorsement. And so I'm asking the court not to engage in that for the same reason that I would ask the court to take up the waste issue. Because there is a finding in this case as a matter of law, and there's a finding as a matter of fact that the continued construction of this lavish home benefited the community. The community still has the asset, and the notion that that could ever, as a matter of logic and law, equal waste is anathema to 25318, and I think the court really should, because it's interpreting a statute, publish on the issue and look
at the
terms.
Wasn't there some confusion in the court's order about waste?
I'm sorry?
There was some confusion in the court's order about waste, about did they prove waste, didn't they prove waste?
I don't think there was confusion. I think the court entered a waste judgment that was defective at so many levels, not only the fact of the waste judgment, but the way in which it works, in which the way the court calculated the value of it was whatever husband pays toward the debt on the property, he has to pay 50% more and pay it to wife.
So now let me ask you.
The court just expanded the debt by 50%.
On remand, and I ask this because I think it seems to me there's confusion on the court's part. Was this a waste issue or was this a preliminary injunction issue? Because the husband did some of this in violation of the preliminary injunction, and the court certainly was within its discretion to do it there. And in the realm of we could affirm on any ground.
Well, I certainly don't concede that husband violated the preliminary injunction, and I will represent to the court that the Superior Court's decision is quite clear that this was a waste decision. It was
right.
Muddled, it went back and forth, but ultimately decided waste because the husband has an economics degree. The parties agree.
Okay, but on remand, the court, what we're saying is court needs to clarify that because it is. It's sort of confusing because I'm like, what was the violation? Because he did these things, he encumbered without wife's consent, which is
Your Honor,
a prima facie preliminary injunction issue.
Except, Your Honor, that's only one characterization of the record, and I do not concede
okay,
that.
Okay, that's fair, but because the Superior Court
because
decided.
Because the parties incurred this liability before service of the petition. This was a voluntary
not all
liability.
No, he incurred some more liability after the service of the petition. I think that's clear in the record.
Well, some of the liability that husband incurred actually was mishandled in a different way under the Schickner claim because he incurred a liability to the contractor, borrowed additional money, and now that money is also being asked to somehow be paid to wife. So now husband is under an obligation under this judgment to borrow money and pay it to somebody who has no obligation to pay it back. That's not Schickner. The entire debt on this property was so mishandled, I hate to say, by the Superior Court, that it is very difficult. You and I are having difficulty even describing what the Superior Court said. And I don't fault either one of us for that. It is difficult to understand what the court's reasoning was. But one thing that is very clear is that the court reasoned that waste can exist when the community still has the property and it can be justified by the educational level of one spouse.
Well,
now, what if both spouses have degrees?
But if I go out, let's say husband went out, took out this loan, and bought his, I'll use a girlfriend, for lack of a better term, a brand new house, but now this one has this huge mortgage on it.
Well, that
would
Honor,
be waste, but they still own the property.
No, they don't own the proceeds of the property because that has been alienated to another party, and that is 25318 waste. But here, the loan, all of the value is in this property. Now, the property may have negative equity, but all of the value is in this property.
But waste can also be made on a really bad judgment. Waste isn't just gave it to someone else. So if he made a really bad judgment and wasted their money, invested in Tinker Toys because he thought they were going to be the great new phase for 2026. And so that folks know, I'm going to add, I think, are folks okay if I add 10?
Yes.
I'm going to add 10 minutes to everybody because we do understand this is complicated and okay. I want people to have that opportunity. So let's just focus on that. I don't see that they are continued ownership of the house or even that he thought he was helping the house if he did something to just make it economically unfeasible, that could ultimately be found.
I think a better analogy, and first of all, I think we need to look at 25318 and look at the words that it uses. Expenditures, destruction, concealment, or disposition. All of those imply that the property is no longer available for division. And the, we can go to the Svansdotter case, which makes clear that the property has to be unavailable for division. Unwise investments happen all the time. There was a time during the Great Recession when every estate that came to this court or to the Superior Court was underwater. Every home was not worth what was paid for it. And we still we don't have to look at it in these heady economic terms. Look at it as a normal wage earner who gets underwater buying a very, very expensive Mercedes, and that's enough to crush the
company. Okay, I'm sorry, I'm a little distracted because I'm focused on getting you your time. Okay.
Oh, okay.
Not ignoring you, you're up.
Thank you. People at much smaller scales get in over their heads.
Council, I think that we have covered the waste issue. We understand statute we need to look at. I really want to turn because we are, limited on time.
Yes.
I want to understand your argument about Schechner because I think that the court sort of referenced it. You reference it in your pleadings. The other party referenced it in their pleadings. I really want to be clear because I have to say the briefing is not totally clear. What are you arguing Schechner applies to, the assets specifically, and what are you asking us to say about it?
Okay. I'm glad you asked. I'll make it super simple. I am asking that for money that husband puts into a business, if the business is merely a pass-through where husband puts money in and takes that money out, that is not a profit or a gain cognizable by Schechner. And husband should not be, in this case, the evidence is undisputed, that loans accounted for the money that came out of the business. Husband borrowed the money, put it in the business, he took it out. But the fact that husband borrowed money does not implicate Schechner. Schechner applies to profits and gains, not loan proceeds. And so
did the asset of the community guarantee that loan at all?
I'm sorry?
Did the asset of the community, the business, guarantee that loan at all? Didn't he sign all that as president of the corporation and as himself individually?
Well, Your Honor, the security arrangements, I'm going to have a difficult time answering that with precision, as did the Superior Court, because the security arrangements here also involved a pledge of the PV residence, which was signed by both spouses, and the collateral
account
of these loans.
Counsel, I'm going to interrupt you there because, yes, the initial obligation was signed by both parties. But after the date of legal separation, my understanding of the record, what I have seen, the loan documents, it is only husband who signed subsequent loans. We have documents that the builder sort of forgives these loans and within the same day, reestablishes them and husband signs for them. So I have questions about whether wife agreed to them or not. The record is very muddled on that, and I appreciate whatever trouble you had at the Superior Court in trying to find that out, and the Superior Court judge in trying to walk through those issues. But I think what I'm struggling with is I understand your arguments about Schickner, and I thank you for saying it applies to the profits and gains, but I'm struggling with you characterizing it as it was, they were loans that the community had agreed to.
Well, what I actually said, Your Honor, is that the collateralization of the whole house is something that at least in part the parties did both sign.
Okay, at least in part. Yeah, I agree with that.
Well, but this isn't just the obligation to take on the construction. This is the actual assignment of the interest, the pledge of the interest in the residence. And that's important to remember.
And that was all done before the parties separated, correct?
Yes, and I don't
and then it was released. I mean, I guess that's part of what the Superior Court has to look at and go, and then it was expressly released, and then there was an attempt to reestablish it, but without wife's signature. That's a challenge.
I think, Your Honor, we may be talking about two different transactions.
Yes, I think you
are. I'm sorry.
Yeah, we are.
And so that can lead to some confusion. I don't have an IR number for you, but if you look at documents in the record beginning with Bates' label, husband 2385, I think you will see what I'm talking about. The collateralization of the home was complex. And that's one of the reasons that remand on the home, I think, requires remand on the business and sort of cascading down. The loans did not only come from the builder. The loans came from family members. They came from other sources. And it doesn't matter if they were secured, unsecured, or came from sole and separate property. Whatever those contributions were, they are neither profits nor gain. They are contributions. They are capital contributions, perhaps financed through debt, but perhaps not. But they are capital contributions that do not give rise to a Schickner claim. If they did, the business would effectively be precluded from taking on capital during the entire pendency of a divorce, because every piece of capital invested, or every dollar of capital invested, would then have to be multiplied by 150% because it was going to be paid out to a party who typically would not own part of the business anymore.
I appreciate that.
It's credit for dollars in and dollars out. That's the whole Schickner argument.
Okay. Thank you.
So I hope that answers your question. I appreciate very much the court's indulgence as far as time, but I'm down to 4 minutes, and unless the court has a question right now, I'd reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
All right.
Thank you.
And let's make sure we add the time to counsel's 30 minutes. You don't have to use it all, though, counsel.
Okay.
I think you will, but nothing personal on that. One will go.
Nothing personal taken. Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Christina Hamilton. I represent Lee Biltis. I think the briefing shows some things that we should just knock out right away because it's easy. The Paradise Valley home has to be resolved. Interest on judgments is appropriate and should have been included in the decree. Some things that may be moot due to the bonds are whether wife should have gotten a credit against the judgments husband owed her versus having a certain equalization payment due to husband of $66,000, monthly payments on Schickner, attorney's fees, and tag CB may be moot because the bonding will pay off those judgments. So I think those things are probably less important right now. There is no real objection espoused in their briefing on the $156,900 fee award, any legal basis or abuse of discretion basis. So I think that stands. There's no need to
But counsel, does it stand if we send this back for review? And I mean, we've already, you haven't mentioned it. You mentioned PV Home, and that's an issue. But if we're sending this back, doesn't the court have to relook at everything based on attorney's fees and what happened there?
Well, I don't know that that's necessary to send everything back, but even if that were to be the result, I think that what the court was doing was saying wife was underfunded throughout this entire case, husband was spending money out the yin-yang, out of the business, including for his own attorney's fees, and on a financial disparity basis, she should get this $156,900 in fees because he was spending a lot more than she was, and yet she needed fees to pursue the litigation.
So I guess what I'm getting at, though, is rather than affirming that order, if we're sending this back, shouldn't it just be reconsidered as well? I'm not saying it was right or wrong, but shouldn't it all be reconsidered based on the facts as the court looks at things anew?
Yeah, I don't agree with that, only because through August of 2024, when we had the trial, wife had to incur fees, husband had monies and incurred fees, husband didn't provide monies to wife. So to get wife through that litigation, I think it was an appropriate award, and I don't know that that has to be re-looked at if everything else goes down.
Thank you. That's helpful.
Setting aside the issue of the attorney's fees, though, do you agree that, since there is agreement, I should say, on the PV home, that that's sort of the first domino, and with that, everything else falls, such that the court has to redo the entire distribution?
No, I do not agree.
Okay.
I think the PV home is the PV home, right? It's a house. It has, the court said, wife is responsible for the first $4.5 million of loans taken out to buy the lots. She's responsible for half of the $10 million on the mid-first loan that she did sign. And beyond that, whatever the equity is in the house, she gets 50%. So if the house is sold, she gets her 50%. Husband wants to suggest he wants to keep the house. Well, then he's depriving her of her property. So, and the court said, and if the builder takes any of that money, that's waste, and wife gets 50% as against husband.
But what happens to the money that husband put in after, because I look at the separation date, right?
Right.
And so husband, you know, I'm assuming obviously he incurred more debt, but he also supposedly put more money into the home. Should the court not consider those things as well?
Right. So,
I mean, if you're saying 50-50, then you're kind of not taking that into account necessarily.
Okay. So, first of all, I guess I want to say two things. ARS 25-318 allows for the in-kind division. That's clear. So that's on tag ES. ARS 25-214 says that joinder of both parties is required in the following cases: any transaction for the encumbrance on an interest in real property, any transaction of guarantee, or to bind the community irrespective of any person's intent with respect to that binder after service of a petition for dissolution of marriage if the petition results in a decree of dissolution. So all of the debt that husband claims he incurred with the builder was post date of service, and he never asked for, much less got wife's signature on that. He never got wife's signature on guarantees or putting encumbrances on the PV home. Husband did 100% of that by himself. And what the court below said is, yeah, you can't do that. That's invalid. You can't take her property away like that. So if you chose to do that, that's your problem. You could have come to her and asked. You didn't. And in fact, in September of 2022, when they were considering whether to get this mid-first bank loan, husband came to wife and said, look, you can either sign for this mid-first bank loan that had interest at about 8 to 8.75%, or I'll just borrow it from the builder at 10 or 11%. And so wife was kind of put in a catch-22, signed with mid-first. Well, at the same time, husband, without wife's knowledge or consent, is allegedly borrowing money from the builder. The builder then says at the end of December, there's nothing owed. And now we go into 2023, and now the builder and husband say, well, there was something owed. Husband takes it as a separate debt. And it says right in there, husband personally, independently, takes it as a separate debt. And then by March of 2023, he signs an amended promissory note increasing what he claims is due the builder, again, without wife's knowledge or consent. And then in March of 24, he puts two deeds of trust on the PV home, one for the builder, up to $35 million, one for Tag ES, up to $25 million, again, without wife's permission or consent. So all of that is invalid under the statute, meaning That's husband's separate debt. That's his problem, and he
Which is why I say, didn't the Superior Court kind of mesh a preliminary injunction and a waste claim? Because the waste claim is based on those loans as well. Is it, I mean, and it could arguably be both, but doesn't the Superior Court need to make clear what it is and how it's doing it? Because you seem to be very focused on it's a violation of the preliminary injunction, and that means it's on husband, whatever it was.
Okay, so 25214 is not the preliminary injunction.
I'm sorry.
25315 is the preliminary injunction, and that's also been violated. But 25214 says without, you know, without any other issue, you have to have joinder of both parties.
Right. And I'm just, sorry, but I did kind of mix them and put them in one bucket.
Yeah.
Because it's the same issue on both of them.
Right. So when husband does all of this extracurricular, taking out money, doing loans, putting liens on property, he can't do that via the statute. It's just not allowed. So wife can't be punished for that by saying, well, you got to chip in, because those are his separate debts, and he wasn't allowed to encumber them with the residence.
Did the trial court account for those monies that you're saying were taken out separately by husband in terms of whatever value those extra monies added to the PV home in terms of the distribution of whatever future equity there may be? Because, you know, I'm assuming, I don't know, and I don't know if the record is clear on this, but that if that money was used to finish the construction of this home, that took it, it was worth a certain amount at the time of separation, and then it was worth a different amount once it's completed. Did the trial court's distribution account for, you know, the sort of difference in price at those two points, taking into account these monies you claim were separate debts or debts that the wife didn't authorize?
No, they didn't. I don't think that was even addressed by husband at the court level. But at the court trial level, there was three appraisals at $25 million. The expert for husband said maybe the house could sell for $30 million. So that those were the numbers the court had in front of it, and husband was already spending in excess of $40 million on this house, spending most of it after post-decree, or I'm sorry, after post-date of service, and without wife's knowledge or consent, and without any records of any kind that were provided, even though they were asked repeatedly for the underlying receipts of the builder to support that there was this loan.
But there were, none of those appraisals spoke to what the value of the property was at the time of the separation, is that right?
Well, I not on the specific date of separation, but there were appraisals in 2022, which is the same year of separation, that came in at $25 million.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, and then husband starts borrowing all this extra money.
Counsel, yes. While we're sort of on the waste topic, mm-hmm. So the court in its decision first found that husband created waste to the community by the additional costs and in subsequent debt incurred with builder and MidFirst and interest payments to MidFirst. Mm-hmm. That was a specific finding in its order.
Right.
But then earlier on in its order, I think it was, might have been later, it says, it was actually before, it says, the court found this case does not present a unique set of facts or circumstances, therefore an equal division of community property is appropriate to achieve equity. How do you kind of resolve those two issues if we're supposed to uphold the waste judgment?
Okay, so first of all, whether you call it waste or whether you call it that wife cannot and the properties cannot be responsible under 25214 for these debts, I think that's getting a little bit into language issues versus reality issues. What the court said was, wife didn't sign for these obligations. She didn't agree that these were going to be liens on the house, so therefore she can't.
Well, and so I'm going to push back a little bit on that, because I don't think it's sort of using the same words to say the same thing. I think waste is basically like a punishment almost. Like, you either failed to comply with the preliminary injunction or, you know, binded the community, and therefore we're not going to look at these things, versus you entered these things contrary to 214, and therefore they're your separate things. I do think they're two different concepts, and I don't think we should be mixing them. But basically what you're saying is, no matter what, all of that stuff should be husband's. But again, I don't know how we kind of make the understand what the court really meant on the waste judgment or allocation of that debt when it says in one hand it should be divided equitably, and in the second case it's saying there was waste.
And in the third case, and the court does say this, they say 25214D did not allow husband to bind wife to any of these debts. So you have to put that in the mix too. And what the court ultimately comes down and says is, look, wife's going to be responsible for mid-first, wife's going to be responsible for the purchase of the two lots that built the home. But beyond that, she didn't sign up for any debt. And so if the builder comes in and tries to take that equity, which I think presumes it was supposed to be sold, the house, but she doesn't say those words. But if the builder comes in and takes that equity, then that is waste to wife of 50% of whatever the builder takes. And
but it's also already given her credit for those debts in how it allocated the money being spent.
I'm not quite following.
In other words, in how it's going to divide the money, it says she's going to get 50% if you don't count the builders.
Right.
And then she's also going to get a waste judgment out of it.
I think the judge was clear that she gets 50% after those two debts, but if the builder comes in and asserts his lien rights or his loan rights and that prevails and that takes money away from the home equity, then husband is responsible for waste for 50% because he put those invalid liens and made those separate debts, and yet wife's getting punished for them. So that's how I read what she's saying.
Okay.
I don't know that there's any disagreement with the court that 25318 allows for in-kind division, so I'm not going to cover that unless there's a question about that. As far as husband's claim that wife has to be responsible for all of this debt because she signed the original contract, contract with the builder. The original contract with the builder, and I encourage the court to look at these paragraphs, in 5.4, 27.1, and 27.4 specifically say the owner can terminate the contract at any time it wants. It also specifically says the construction company can terminate if they want. And 5.4 says, and by the way, if we're not getting paid, we're stopping construction until this gets resolved. The builder further testified at court, in my normal case, if they quit paying me, I stop work. So there was no requirement for husband to continue to take all this money out over the years that passed the date of service. And he did that knowing that it was not increasing the equity in the house whatsoever. Husband argues that wife wanted the construction to be completed. Well, that's kind of belied by the fact that all of a sudden in the end of 2022, wife is now demanded to sign for this mid-first line of credit that she didn't understand was coming, and then secondarily files immediately in January of 2023 for a temporary order to sell the house to stop the spending, to stop incurring more debt than equity in the house. And on temporary orders, she was denied that relief because the house was not going into foreclosure. And under Saxon versus Riddell, the court said, I can't order that on a temporary orders basis. Husband argues that there is no waste because we still have the house. That's kind of yin and yang to me because, yeah, the house is still sitting there, but husband then claims, I want to be awarded the house. I don't want to have to pay wife anything for the house. Matter of fact, I think wife owes me about $6 million for the debt I had to take out to finish the house. So where is wife getting her value out of the house? She has to have it sold to get that value, or husband has to pay her for her value, and he's not suggesting he's going to do that. The husband claims partially Tag ES paid for some of the build, and that is now what's called trade payables on the books of the company. And since she owns 50% of the company, She has a responsibility, as does husband, that those trade payables that are monies that are owed to the taxes, health insurance, what have you, get paid. So she's on the line as far as being an owner of TAG 50% for that too. So it wasn't like she's just sitting on the sidelines waiting for husband to pay. He had paid the builder over $21 million by September of 2022, and then they take out the loan from MidFirst for $10 million in the end of 2022. As far as TAG CB is concerned, this is an abuse of discretion standard as to what the value is that the court assigned to TAG CB, and the court assigned the value of $6 million and ordered husband to pay $3 million. That does not require that the other named owners be indispensable parties, because the evidence was clear. All of the money for TAG CB came from assets of TAG ES that they put into a different entity. The other people didn't pay anything. TAG ES calls it on their consolidated financial statement. TAG CB is a part of it. And there was no evidence that the other people were anything other than named owners.
Well, in doing the decree, did the Superior Court at all resolve their interests? It awarded it.
It didn't not resolve it. I mean, it just said, you guys figure it out. But I'm saying to you, husband, you pay her $3 million for her interest in TAG CB. Whatever that percentage is you want to call it, that's what I'm saying you owe her for her half share.
And it's not binding on those other people. They can still come in and sue TAG, whichever one it is.
Right.
And say, hey, we have a 50% ownership interest, and that's a separate lawsuit altogether, and it has no... The decree doesn't affect it, and it doesn't affect the decree.
Correct.
So let me ask you a question, the receivership. Because counsel has two positions. One, questions the how often the court should be able to do and under what circumstances, even on a temporary basis, put a receivership in place. And there are cases out there about when it might be appropriate. And then also the permanent receivership. Do you agree that a permanent receivership post-decree, court can never come back and change it because that's a final property order, that was inappropriate?
No, so, I don't.
So why is that allowed?
Okay, because the court said we need somebody in here to turn the ship around on the business, and that receiver is going to be in place until the court orders otherwise, or until the parties agree otherwise, or until there is a bankruptcy.
I understand what you're saying there, but I'm going to interrupt because how does the court have jurisdiction after the entry of a decree to come back in and terminate the receivership?
Because the receiver is an arm of the court, and if he's an arm of the court, that person's position,
if you will. But property orders are done with the decree.
Right.
And the court loses jurisdiction at that point over the property. I'm struggling with how the court could ever come back and change it, because it's not allowed to go in and do that. Or is the decree not final? Is this really a moot appeal, an appeal we should dismiss because the court still has jurisdiction over the property, and the 84C or whatever number it is language was not appropriate? Because honestly, I'm struggling with that, because if you're saying the court retained jurisdiction, then it's not a final judgment.
The court retained jurisdiction to terminate the receiver, not that the 50-50 ownership of TAG would be changed.
But what basis in the law can you provide us to show that it maintains that jurisdiction?
In a
divorce case with a decree.
Well, I don't know that ACLE was clear that this was a pre-decree. I mean, it talked about the fact that their estate had to be turned around and that there needed to be receiver until.
But is it the court's job to turn it around after the decree is done? I get it. The court's pre-decree, and I've sat there. Pre-decree, you got to try and keep it going and get parties to the finish line. But the finish line for the court is the decree. What happens afterwards isn't the court's business, is it?
I think what you're saying is, should wife then go to the civil court and get the
Well, that is a remedy that everybody has when they own a business. If she thinks something's wrong, then go into civil court, exercise your rights as a 50-50 partner or whatever member, whatever structure it is.
Right. And I understand that might be a procedural way to do it, and I'm not arguing against you on that, but on the same token, the Superior Court is the Superior Court, and it's there for everybody. So if you go into the civil court and get that same relief, why can't the divorce court give it to you?
Because you might have a right to a jury trial and everything else. They're just two separate actions, and you can maintain both.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right, or consolidate them. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I wanted to get to the Schickner issue before I run out of
Please.
Time. So again, this is an abuse of discretion standard because the court had the right to make the Schickner decisions, and they don't even argue that the court did not have the legal right to make that decision. And I don't really understand husband's position because here's what happened. In 2022, all these distributions come out to husband. Some of that was $40,000 for furniture that husband owns. Some of it was to pay Azule, the builder, which the court said wife's not responsible for. In 2023, so the next year, husband unilaterally takes out $2 million of loans from this Azule, the builder, doesn't ask wife to sign on them, acknowledges they're his separate debt. He takes these debts out without wife's knowledge or consent. And then he says, I'm putting that money back into the business to pay down the debt that I owe to Tag ES. And look, I'm paying it off with my separate property. So what husband is now arguing is that even though that $2 million is his separate debt, and even though he put that in to pay down his, what he calls his member's note to Tag ES, that he says is anywhere from $25 to $41 million, depending on what day you talk to him. I want wife to be responsible for that $2 million I put back in, and that should be given a credit against what I owe under Schickner. So he's essentially asking for wife to pay half of the debt that he alone incurred. And that's just, A, not allowable, but B, okay, if husband put separate monies into Tag, then either his separate debt to Tag has been reduced by that amount, or he loaned money to the company, and Tag ES now has a responsibility to pay back that loan to the lender, just like it has in any other lenders. But that has nothing to do with wife's Schickner claim, nothing. And it comes so far after the fact, I don't even understand why husband is suggesting that has anything to do with the Schickner claim. The Scottsdale credit I also wanted to talk about, and that is the decree said if wife could have the Scottsdale house, now Scottsdale, not PV, but she had to refinance by the end of November of 2024. She couldn't, and she asked for an extension of time to get additional time to get refinance. The judge said no. So in November of 2024, everyone knew that the house had to be sold because she couldn't get it refinanced. On January 6th of 2025, the judge denies her extension on the refinance. Okay, so again, we all know it's going to have to be sold. Whatever comes out of the house comes out of the house. And then on January 8th, she makes this ruling that the equity in the house is over $1,355,000, therefore giving husband a credit against the Schickner judgment for half of that amount, which is $667,000. Knowing that the house is going to be sold, there was no need for, nor really ability for the court to enter that equity judgment because husband was going to get his 50%.
But wife asked the court to do it, didn't she?
Well, she said in a pleading when we're trying to figure out what it is she had to refinance, how much is it going to be? But when the court denied all the refinancing, that was kind of the end of that issue. Now we have a sale of the house, and whatever happens on the sale of that house, that should be the credit that husband gets, 50%.
If we send it back, shouldn't that be the result? I mean, if we have to unpack everything, then wouldn't that be certainly what should happen on remand?
That he get a credit for only half of the net?
Correct.
Yes, I agree.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let me ask you, because I asked counsel, If we undo the PV home, it seems everything else may crumble. I know you don't want it to, but let's say it does. What issues do we need to address for clarity if it goes back? And he had mentioned the PV home, the receivership issue,
And do I have the other thing?
I'm trying to think where my notes are.
The Kelsch issue.
The Kelsch issue?
The issue with regard to...
50-50 ownership.
I think he's...
The 50-50 ownership.
Right. And again, 25318 says the court shall divide the community property, not necessarily in kind, which pretty much on the face of the statute then says, but you can use in kind. We accept and agree that you can use in kind division. What I believe husband is arguing is you can't use that on a community-owned business. That for some reason, in kind does not apply to community-owned businesses. And there's no cases that he cited that say that. There are cases he cites that say, hey, there might be occasions where it may be better to award the house to you and order you to pay 50% of the value to the other spouse, but that does not take in-kind division off the table. And the court was allowed to do that, and that's where I think he's arguing Kelsch. But that's not what the statute says. Statute says in-kind is fine. And as you pointed out, people jointly own businesses all the time. These people jointly owned this business before the decree entered, I mean, by operation of community property law. So there was nothing wrong with the judge giving wife her 50% interest, particularly when husband kept saying, I want 100% and I want you, wife, to pay me millions and millions of dollars to offset all of this debt that I've incurred. I do want to bring up the spousal maintenance issue. The court ordered that wife was entitled to spousal maintenance and then ordered that husband couldn't afford to pay it due to his post-service debts. I want to remind the court that, A, I don't think that's a valid basis to deny wife her entitlement to spousal maintenance, but, B, it doesn't really make any sense in lieu of the testimony because husband testified he wasn't paying off the debts. He was having tag, yes, pay off the debts by continuing to use the float from that entity. He could have sold the house. That would take away almost all of his debts. He wasn't willing to do that. And he acknowledged in multiple pleadings that tag CB, which he was awarded, has significant economic power and resources. And so he had far more resources that should have been used to pay spousal.
But didn't the court, in declining to award spousal maintenance, didn't they look at the fact that wife was getting a $100,000 salary from Tag ES, and that was really the reason why the court didn't award the spousal maintenance?
No, it did look at the $100,000 totally. It's the husband got $275,000, wife got $100,000. It did. But even on that basis alone, there's a financial disparity between the two. What the court said was husband can't afford to pay it because of all of these debts.
But isn't that something under the statute that the court can consider?
The statute says that they can look at the financial resources of both parties, but using post-service debt to deny a spouse spousal maintenance when the court has already said she's entitled, I think is questionable at best. And then again, on top of that, the evidence was clear. Husband wasn't paying the debt.
So, but if we vacate the property, the court has to go back and look at spousal maintenance anew because one of the factors is what property is the spouse getting?
Right.
What if on remand the court gives wife nothing? Then spousal maintenance looks very different. So don't we have to vacate given the factors for spousal maintenance? And say court... as part of the property, you know, once you know what the property is, then you can look at whether wife should receive spousal maintenance. Because let's say it goes back and gives husband both tags and the PV home and gives wife Scottsdale home and nothing else, then that financial aspect is very different.
So it
really depends.
I agree, but I don't get over the hump of why you would remand on tag ES because they have not shown you that they are not allowed for in-kind division. So that should stand, and now we're talking about the PV home, and yes, could financial resources change the spousal maintenance? Yes, of course it could.
But isn't the PV home, I know we're at time, but the PV home is the elephant in the middle of the room, and
sure.
The rest of the things are just little moons circling around. So if we undo the elephant in the room, the moons may shift, and the court may have to shift some of those moons
right,
to reach an equitable result.
Right, but I don't know that that means you have to undo the moon of the Taggy Yes Division.
Okay, I get it.
Thank you.
Thank
I appreciate
you.
Your time.
Counsel. And you can call it the sun if you want instead of an elephant in the room. I realize I mixed some metaphors there of planets, moon, sun, I don't know what.
If the moon's small enough, the gravitational equations could work. Your Honor, 4 minutes has never seemed so short. Let me hit tag CB first. The court did make a finding here. First, it found that wife's position concerning tag CB was unreasonable, and then it went on, and I quote, to say, wife's position ignores the legitimate property interests of third parties. Wife did not request that any third parties be joined so that their interests could be determined. So the court started on the right track. The problem is it inverted the logic of the Garrow decision to the great financial detriment of husband, because it first valued the entire enterprise and used that value as the basis for an equalization payment. Garrow was the opposite. Garrow upheld a decision to allow the proportion of division, 50-50 division, to be established in the family case, subject to whatever value came out of other civil litigation. Here, that number was fixed, and it was fixed without the property interests of the third parties, meaning if those property interests actually were 50%, husband got double charged. ARS 25214.
Let me ask you this. If husband was worried about being double charged, he could have brought him in too. It's not just wife's fault that this happened.
Well, I mean, it's not really a question of fault as much as
How is wife unreasonable? Because if she was unreasonable not bringing him in, husband was equally unreasonable.
Your Honor, I think the more critical point here is that the court erred.
I just want to focus because I'm not sure I think anything was unreasonable with that with regard to that. I'm not the judge, but I struggle with how wife was unreasonable by not bringing him in and husband wasn't. But move on, because I know you got little time.
Right, okay. So ARS 25214 has been presented as though it is a law governing the relation between spouses that then figures into marital division. It's not. It deals with the problem trial judges face every single day in family court, which is allocating debts and having those orders not be binding on third-party creditors. It may be true that under 25214, certain of these debts are not binding on third-party creditors. That has nothing to do with the division of the house, which didn't happen anyway. I would point out to the court two passages from the trial court's findings that I think belie some of the characterization you just heard. The court found that although the house cannot be currently sold at break even, meaning there's no way to convey good title even if the court orders it sold, the finalization of the construction has been a benefit to the community. This was a pre-service obligation that husband merely performed, and 25214 only really affects the rights of third parties. And then the other portion that I've got to point the court to is where the trial court finds that wife had access to and signed many of the PV home documents. Simply choosing to no longer participate does not absolve her of liability. The court finds, however, that husband's economics degree changes the picture. If that's enough to change the picture, we have to then ask, is it a PhD, a BA, Harvard, Gonzaga? I mean, how do we weigh those things? And are we at the same time throwing out the statutory prohibition against consideration of marital misconduct when we paternalistically come in and say, well, you should have been the more responsible one? I mean, frankly, if I were wife, I'd be offended by that statement, that just because somebody has a degree, they are somehow more competent. But We can't
or
try.
Could we also take it as should have known better? Not more competent, but just should have known better.
I'm very concerned that inquiry itself is an abuse of discretion, Your Honor.
Okay.
And I am out of time, I see, so I appreciate the court's indulgence. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, folks.
We ask that...
Go ahead. Finish your sentence.
The decree be vacated and the matter remanded.
All right. Thank you, folks. I appreciate the argument. Was happy to give you the extra 10 minutes. You used all of them. We'll take it under advisement. We'll issue a ruling in due course.
Thank you, Your Honor.